Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which always remembers to take at least one banana to every party. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Todd.
And I'm Simon.
It's the 51st century and Samsung has just released its first range of clockwork Android devices. Let's see how well that all turns out as we watch The Girl in the Fireplace.
So Stephen Moffat's back. He's already given us a two-part story in season one, and here is his first single 45-minute episode. And I've avoided watching this for quite a long time since he's been a showrunner, because I thought coming back to it, I might see a lot more of his tropes, which, you know, he's using probably for the first time. And so we've got a cold open, and I have to say that he really does know how to hook you in. Simon?
Yes, it's almost like we've started with the cliffhanger to episode three because you've already got a character who we've never met before in the program who obviously knows who the Doctor is, but it's not done in that sort of rubbish way where, oh yes, I remember meeting the Doctor back on the planet Zog in the 52nd century.
Yeah.
It's as if we're already well into the story, and we sort of are, because that's what actually happens at the sort of roughly the three-quarter mark of the episode. But I too actually hadn't watched it for many, many years. I don't know how long. I've sort of been only watching the new series as it's come out, and then, you know, the Blu-ray box set sort of like 12 months behind, kind of like it used to be back in the 70s in Britain, where you just get, like, you know, a repeat of Genesis of the Daleks or something at Christmas in between the seasons. But coming back to it after all these years, it really does actually remind me how brilliant Moffat was, and how much we really wanted Moffat to be the showrunner at the time, because, you know, his episodes, I feel it anyway, and I think a lot of people do, his episodes in the Russell T Davies era are the best, I think, and this is no exception. In fact, it's probably the best of all of them.
It is really something, I think. I also hadn't watched it for about 10 years, and I can never quite work out why I avoid them. So last week we did School Reunion, obviously, and that's one that I put on from time to time. But I really hadn't watched The Girl in the Fireplace for maybe a decade.
I still haven't.
James, that's why you're not allowed on the podcast.
So you haven't seen it?
I haven't rewatched it.
Right. I noticed, Nathan, you just said you've avoided it. You've avoided this particular episode, or just the entire era?
No, I tend to avoid the Moffat ones, and I'm not quite sure why. I think partly because their tone is different to the surrounding episodes, and they're notable for not having been rewritten by Russell. So I always imagine they're going to be a little bit less fun than an RTD episode. You know, like I would put School Reunion on or New Earth on before I put Girl in the Fireplace on. But I think there's also a kind of feeling that they're sort of special and I don't want to waste them either. Certainly, I am quite wrong, because Girl in the Fireplace is incredibly funny, like really, really very clever and funny and super, super enjoyable. But I don't know. There's a more somber tone to Moffat's episodes. It's the same with The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances. You know, I would watch Aliens of London and World War III before I would watch those, even though rewatching them, I'm just astounded by how incredibly good they are.
I think the silliness level for me, and that's an argument we've had privately over many years, and I think for me it's because the silliness is more central to something like Aliens of London, certainly something like Aliens of London. Whereas with the Moffat stuff and with Girl in the Fireplace, you've got a lot of sort of silliness that goes on, which is more incidental. And I think that's perhaps what I like most about it, and it's the flavour of it, which I really, really love. And it's because it is so much more serious, and I don't mean serious as in deadly serious earnest. I just mean there's more, it just feels like there's more gravity, there's more at stake, even though it's actually just the life of one woman.
Yeah.
It's only the life of one woman that's at stake. And there's no talk about, oh, it's going to change the course of history if Madame de Pompadour is not blah, blah, blah. That's all irrelevant. It's literally just the safety of this one person.
but it sort of shows how important one person can be, even though, you know, like, it's not universe shattering.
Yes, but it's important because we like her. It's not that old sort of thing that, oh, everyone's lives is important, and that's an important message, an important sort of thing that's been happening in the new series. It doesn't have to be a king or a queen or an empress for their life to be important. It can just be an individual. But it's just the scale of it, which is it feels both epic while still being intimate. And yes. I think that's an interesting combination, which I don't think there's a formula for. I don't think you can't recreate that. It just, to some extent, happened by accident. But I happen to sort of feel that a lot of the best of Doctor Who actually happens by accident.
Oh, yeah.
The emotional stakes in this episode are incredible. And I think Sophia Miles is just amazing as Renette, and she's got a great chemistry with David Tennant. And it really makes me want to have a companion from the past with the Doctor. Like, you're not going to get it here, but it's something that the new series hasn't done, and I would love that.
Interestingly, though, an alternate version of the ending of this story written by Moffat was that she would come with them.
It's interesting, too, the contrast between 2 weeks ago where historical figures, you know, quite august and revered historical figures were kind of poked fun at. And that was critiqued. I mean, that wasn't just kind of left unaddressed. It was a problem. But the Doctor and Rose were, like, super dismissive of Queen Victoria, who showed a sort of dignity that sort of surpassed their kind of mockery. Whereas here, she is an incredibly impressive person. And not just because of her historical accomplishments, but just because of the way that she interacts with the Doctor.
They don't make the mistake, which is frequently made, that an historical person is stupid. You know, we're just as intelligent now as we were in the 3rd century BC. It's just that we've got all this stuff to start us off that we know that we can then kind of learn all these other things. And the beauty is that she comes across as a highly intelligent and perceptive person.
Yeah.
When she understands what Rose is saying about the fact that there's basically this place where all bits of her life are all joined together, and it's not like magic. She doesn't accuse it of being just magic. She sort of just tries to comprehend it and manages to. And I think that's great. Yeah.
She comes up with that book analogy, doesn't she, where all the days of her life are like pressed together like pages in a book. She clearly understands it and is even able to kind of explain it to the audience in a way. And, of course, there's the Vulcan mind meld that the Doctor does. Is this his first Vulcan mind meld?
Well, since the Three Doctors.
Yeah, I guess so. And she finds out about him. He is reading her mind.
Ah, yes, but she wasn't supposed to, was she?
No.
He was not expecting that to happen.
No, that's right.
And she's
opened.
The one.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, which adds to her level of, I don't know,
superpower.
Complexity.
Well,
intelligence, I should say. And she talks about, you know, so lonely, you know, very lonely childhood. And that is this the first time that it's really talked about? This is something that Moffat's going to touch on again and again.
Yeah, this is a place where he goes to, because this story, a little bit like The Doctor Dances, is very much about who the Doctor is and what he's like. And you get the mythic Doctor, you know, the Doctor who comes with the monsters, the Doctor who monsters have nightmares about. You know, Moffat has said that Doctor Who takes place, you know, under your bed and
behind the sofa.
Yeah, just sort of very much about the role of the Doctor, and that's something that he will go on to address sort of ad nauseam in his era as showrunner. But it's also about the Doctor as a person, like what was it like for him growing up? And again, you know, look at Listen, and he'll do that again. In fact, he'll make it much more explicit that the Doctor is lonely.
Well, it's the fan thing. It's the fanboy. It's trying to relate to the experience that I think many of us serious fans had as children, and that is that we may not have had very many friends, or certainly not very many quote-unquote normal friends. and so we're wanting – that's one of the reasons why I think we gravitated towards Doctor Who and the kind of person he is. And I think Moffat's just remembering that from his own childhood and feeding it into the fact that the Doctor had that sort of childhood as well.
It's a sort of meta commentary on, you know, the Doctor as a character in a TV program.
The Doctor as the script writer.
Yeah. So for one terrifying moment, I thought I'd accidentally put the 11th Hour DVD in.
Why, Nathan? are you seeing all the different Stephen Moffat tropes in the writing? That's the biggest thing that I sort of was looking at this, you know, straight up, it's suddenly 3,000 years later and you're on a spaceship. He does that quite often. Like there's some sort of time jump to where the Doctor is compared to what's actually going on in things.
Yep.
You've just hit on the fact that the Doctor looks under the bed and there's a jump moment and a scare, and he does that as well. We've got bananas. We've got Doctor dances.
Can I just interrupt the 3,000 years later thing? But you notice how in the opening shot, which goes down to where Madame de Pompadour is, it starts on the same sort of nebula or star field or whatever it is and goes down to Earth. And then you go back to that after the credits and it goes up to the spaceship.
It's really clever, isn't it? You think that it's an opening shot of space,
yes,
and it's the night sky over Versailles.
Which, of course, doesn't actually look like that, but who cares?
No.
And I guess that's something I love. I love the way in which, you know, how does this fireplace in 17th century connect to the 51st century?
Yeah.
Well, why is she screaming into a fireplace?
yes, why is this? He hooks you in and then it's slowly, the story slowly unravels and you're putting it together at the same time as them, but you're slightly ahead, which is something that I think is very old school Doctor Who, like Simon, when we were kids watching the show.
But how fast? Well, I'll come back to what's old school Doctor Who in just a sec. Yep. But what is that thing about those first moments after the credits where the TARDIS arrives and they go out and they have a look? It's so quick the way everything is summarized. Oh, here we are. This is a fireplace, but there's nothing on the other side because I can see straight out the window and there's nothing there. And then you know, all those things are kind of set up so fast. What makes it feel like a classic episode of Doctor Who is you have a scene with other people, and then you have the TARDIS materialising. And I think that, and it happens at the end as well, when the TARDIS leaves, where they actually all decide, oh, okay, we're going now. And that topping and tailing of the episode with that really makes it feel like a classic episode because it's happened so infrequently in the modern era.
Because we start from the TARDIS crew's point of view. Either we're in the TARDIS at the beginning or the TARDIS materialises at the beginning.
Yes.
And we start with our crew.
The first time we saw that was in The Unquiet Dead.
Yeah.
And that's when that episode came on when all this was new. It was like, I went, oh, thank goodness, yes, this is the way it's supposed to be. You start with a scene where there are other people, not the Doctor. And
then drop the Doctor
then drop
in.
Him and the Doctor in, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a surprise that that's in a Stephen Moffat episode. I think Moffat, more than most writers, understands the mechanics of Doctor Who in an obsessive compulsive kind of way and you know, revisits these tropes, not just his own tropes, but the tropes of the show and reimagines and reinvents them constantly, especially when he gets control of the show. And it's one of the things that I find joyous about watching that era of the show, is his grasp of the mechanics of the story.
But isn't it wonderful the way the timey-wimeyness, which is the whole raison d'etre of the story, is actually not overly stupidly complicated. It does actually make sense within the context of the story. Mere mortals can follow it, not just people like us. You know, so it's using those tropes, for want of a better word, but in a way that is kind of accessible.
I think that what's interesting is what you said at the beginning, Simon, is that this is clearly someone who's had a relationship with the Doctor over a long period of time. And we see that long-term relationship start. And the fact that the Doctor's a time traveller means that he can have this long relationship with someone over many, many years in one episode organically. It's not like Zaster from the planet Tigella, who met the Doctor in an unseen episode. We actually see that relationship begin.
Or Asmael.
Yeah. It's all just terribly, terribly clever. And I think the other thing that Moffat does is we think of Doctor Who as a thing that does odd juxtapositions, you know, that makes the mummies into robots.
Yeah, a yeti on the loo in Tooting Bag.
Exactly. That's how we think of Doctor Who. And Doctor Who wasn't actually always so much like that. But that's our memory of what Doctor Who is for. And that's what Moffat does here, and it's the image of that horse on the spaceship that absolutely sells it. And that little bit of dialogue where, you know, Mickey's surprised there's a horse on a spaceship, and the Doctor comes back with, well, pre-revolutionary France is here on a spaceship, you know, get some perspective. What he's done is crashed this sort of space show into a historical frock drama about Madame de Pompadour, and it just works incredibly well. It seems like that's the sort of thing Doctor Who always did, even though it probably wasn't.
It just occurred to me also that this is basically his first draft of River Song.
Yeah.
Like the whole Doctor having a relationship with a woman over a long period of time, not necessarily in the right order.
Yeah.
Which he's going to hang whole seasons on in the future.
But this is the first time the Doctor is someone's imaginary friend when they're a child, and that's exactly what he does with Amy in the 11th Hour as well.
Yes, I was going to say, like, this explicitly says an imaginary friend.
And the Raggedy Man.
Another trope, you know. Yeah. And, of course, you know, they get to have a snog.
This is our first proper snog for the Doctor, I think.
I think so.
Ah, that's an interesting comment, especially because I've just listened to the end of the first season podcast.
Yeah,
so podcast where you're arguing, discussing the kiss, so sucking the yellow goo out of it, whatever.
Yeah, so like on one level that was a science fiction kiss.
Yes,
but on the other level,
what about the kisses in the telemovie, of which there are at least two?
Oh yeah, but there's proper snogging. I was watching David Tennant. He's getting properly into it in a way that Paul McGann wasn't.
Isn't it only in the bedroom when she's an adult for the first time?
Yeah.
She kisses him.
No, but he's into it.
He kisses back.
Yeah, but
I had it on freeze frame. No. I was slow motioning my way through that, Simon.
That's not necessary. Yeah, no, I'm not
saying. You're saying that she's instigating the kiss. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And that's exactly when Rose is possessed by Cassandra in New Earth. She leans in and kisses him, and he just lets it happen rather than recoiling. Yeah, he sort of kisses back a little bit, but it's more the reaction. He loves it as a sense of, yeah, still got it. And it's kind of happened the same sort of deal here. So I don't think the Doctor is a character who goes off actively kissing people.
I think that this is up another level for the Doctor.
But I think if we are accepting that this is going to happen in the program, I think it can work here in the same way that it can work later with River Song and so on. Because she's not actually the companion. I think when it's a bit problematic is when it is the companion. And I think that's why there was a bit of an issue with the Rose moment at the end of season one. But it's because the character of Renette is a character that keeps recurring throughout the program. Every now and again we get them, whether it's, you know, Dr. Todd in Kinder or even someone like Astrid Ferrier in Enemy of the World.
Or Kameka.
No, not Kameka. But it doesn't really happen in the Hartnell era. It's sort of more that sort of Davison era onwards. But it's a mature-aged woman who's not a girl. Most of the companions are girls. We get it from time to time when they're not a girl, whether it's Barbara or Romana or Dr. Shaw, depending on how you define those people. But mainly they're kind of kids, right?
Yeah.
And we've always hankered for these characters, like the women in Stones of Blood. We love them and they're fantastic, but they're only there just for that one story. And in each case, the Doctor seems like he forms a more mature relationship with that person that isn't on the same level as even Sarah and Harry or Leela, or certainly not Tegan and Nyssa and Andrew.
Certainly the companion as child analogy really is very evident in early Davison.
Yeah.
I mean, Nyssa and Adric, I think Matthew Waterhouse brings this up in his autobiography when he's recording a commentary. He talks about how he flashed back 30 years and he and Sarah Sutton were the kids, and Davison and Janet Fielding were the sort of important adults having a serious adult conversation. Oh, and
it's explicitly in dialogue in Four to Doomsday. Remember, the Doctor says to Persuasion, you know what children are like, and he says, I don't, as it happens. But he's talking about Nyssa and Adric. They're definitely children. Mm. And I know what you mean. There is, you know, Doctor Who's been reluctant to have a more mature female companion, arguably, I guess, Donna, who is...
Well, yes, Donna is, yeah, is there. Yeah.
And it works terrifically well. We know that Evelyn works very well on audio with...
The Sixth Doctor.
Yeah, yeah. They're a sort of person that he can have a proper relationship with. And I think Renette, at the time that they kiss, is 23. It's the first time that he meets her as an adult. But by the end of it, she's, what, 37? Like, she's a similar age to how the Doctor looks. And she's not in awe of him. They're very much equals. And I think that makes the relationship seem more credible.
And less groomy.
Yeah. I mean, there are three occasions. This is the first of three occasions where the Doctor meets someone as a child who will become important to him in his later life. And so that's Amy, like Amelia Pond. Mm-hmm. And there was... I think around about season 8, I think there was a
Clara in the playground
scene. Clara in the playground when she was a little girl. And I think by the third time I started to think, actually...
This is a bit creepy.
Yes, I would very much like never to see this again.
Yes, but at least he doesn't form any kind of romantic relationship with him or anything that could be said to be a romantic relationship. Yeah. The other thing is that in the context of being in the TARDIS, being the TARDIS team, is the Doctor is the... one responsible for them all. So it is a kind of a...
duty of care.
There is a... yes, there is a certain level of that which you could read into it, which makes it that little bit icky if something like that were to happen.
It's an inappropriate workplace relationship.
That, exactly that, yeah, yeah.
I think it's really interesting that over the last 3 weeks, in particular, we've had this bond between the Doctor and Rose, like their boyfriend and girlfriend, very much so. And last week, you know, they threw Sarah into the mix to sort of shake up this notion that, is this the case? And because Moffat's writing this week, like, the Doctor is with Renette like a boyfriend-girlfriend thing, whereas Rose is much more, she doesn't seem as phased as what she has in the past. Like, she's with Mickey and they're off on their own little thing. And she's got words to say to Renette, but it's interesting just the way he writes it. It's not as intense a bond like in Tooth and Claw. You know, how they're very much together, whereas here – I don't get that.
You don't get a sense that she's jealous.
I think that that comes from Mickey's dialogue where he is kind of ribbing Rose about what the Doctor's like. You know, last week it was Sarah Jane, a Cleopatra. You know, it's something that the Doctor seems to do. But I don't think Moffat is interested in pursuing that relationship between the Doctor and Rose. And Rose spends pretty much all of her time with Mickey. And I think that because Moffat is a writer of such stature, RTD doesn't rewrite him. If there's something that is going on in the series as a whole that Moffat doesn't want to address, he just gets to leave it alone. It doesn't need to go in that week.
So you know, initially in the early scripting stages of the season, this was planned to be episode 2.
Oh, okay.
And so a lot of what we're talking about eventuated because of its place in the season, right. I think. Once you decide to put it at episode 4, mainly for production reasons because it's so complex,
it
makes sense because you've got them being flirty, then, you know, she meets Sarah Jane and it makes her rethink her relationship with him, and then her boyfriend, quasi ex-boyfriend, comes along and is there, so it sort of shows the relationship in flux.
But isn't it so refreshing not to have her absolutely besotted by the Doctor?
I think it would have been bad to have jealousy again this week after last week's episode. And I do think, whether it's deliberate or inadvertent, like having an episode where the Doctor basically abandons Rose and Mickey on a 51st century spaceship in order to ride a white horse off and rescue his new girlfriend, you know.
So you know that horse?
Arthur.
Mm-hmm. That's the same horse that turns into a Zygon in Day of the Doctor.
He's a recurring actor.
It's a horse with a career.
Maybe it was already a Zygon in that story.
I remember, because I think there's quite a good commentary on this episode with Noel Clarke and Stephen Moffat. They used to release commentary podcasts. It must be where we got the idea from, during early series of the new series. And Moffat says that the scene where he bursts through the mirror on a white horse, that Russell actually came to him and said, I think we have to lose that scene for budgetary reasons.
And he described himself chucking the most epic hissy fit in Christendom or something along those lines.
And it had to be there. It's the Doctor as a romantic hero making a grand, giant romantic gesture. The scene itself, as realised, is not very good.
Do you think?
Yeah,
I think it's the best that it can be.
I mean, there's a little bit of the CGI you can sort of is a bit visible, shall we
it's
say.
It's all composited together and yeah. He moves in a sort of slightly odd way. It doesn't quite work, but certainly attempting to do it was much better than kind of writing around it or having him sort of roll back and mix into the ballroom or something.
I think the realisation of a frog on a chair is worse.
Oh, no, that was a real puppet. That was like a metabolous spider.
Do not criticise that. It would have only been better if it had been Kermit.
Well, let's just say the problem I have with the sequence of him leaping, the horse jumping through the mirror is not the horse, the mirror or the CGI, but the music. So that's the thing that it was the – Murray Gold is comparatively restrained throughout the episode apart from that sequence.
But, I mean, that is the hero moment. I mean, part of Murray's brief, I think, is to leave no Aristeia unturned in being absolutely kind of bombastic.
Oh, I have no doubt. Yeah, I just don't like it.
Mickey and Rose.
Yep.
I really enjoy Noel Clark's performance in this, the growth in Mickey, the joy. I got a spaceship on the first time round. It looks so realistic.
Oh, yes, that lied, is hilarious. That lied, but that's also there for all the people. It's like the Dalek going up the stairs in Remembrance of the Daleks. It's saying, look, Doctor Who's not crappy anymore.
Yeah, and then they get, they get their big guns and investigate the spaceship.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that plot that they have together on the spaceship while the Doctor's off.
Matter de pompering.
Yeah, yeah.
So to speak. Well, I think it's just great to see him investigating things and wanting to know what's going on and the dynamic between him and Billy Piper and how different it is from the first season.
In fact, it's even different from the end of the last episode, isn't it, where she's visibly annoyed that he's been invited onto the TARDIS with them, but that's been completely dropped, I think, for this episode. And I think that's a good thing.
I think it's also indicative of Moffat's approach to stories in Doctor Who, which is that he never wants one story to pick up where another one has left off, and he deliberately does that so that you can slot Big Finish adventures in between them. That's his raison d'etre for that sort of thing. So he said in the Confidential or in interviews around there, he deliberately headcanoned that as there having been quite a lot of time had passed between the end of school reunion and here.
Despite the fact that he says I got a spaceship on my first go.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad that we didn't sort of pursue that because I think that would have been
But also it's icky. I mean, it's the TARDIS, the Doctor Who universe that we aspire to is supposed to be an inclusive place. People are welcome in the TARDIS. I know in practice you don't have like 50 people travelling with the Doctor at a time because that's,
Except in Journey's End.
Not travelling from story to story. But I found all that, and you picked it up with Boomtown on this podcast. It's all a bit awful, and they all look terrible. And it's Mickey that's the one that you feel sorry for.
Yeah.
And I think finally we've moved through that, and we're at a point where, no, Mickey is actually, allowed to be called a companion, everyone. He's travelled into the TARDIS, get stuffed. And in some respects that's being said to Rose, or at least to the Rose of Boomtown.
Yeah, no, Simon, I completely agree with you. And through these episodes here in the middle of the season, he just shows maturity in the character that I don't think is always shown in Rose's character. And, Billy has said that she considers Rose to be fairly selfish. But even at the end of the episode, when the Doctor says he's all right, but Mickey knows, come on, show me around this place. He knows that they need to get out of that to give the Doctor a moment.
I think that's actually really, really good. That's one of my favourite moments in, I think it might be in Tennant's run. Tennant's so mannered and so, sometimes a little bit irritating. And he comes in after losing Renette, after seeing the hearse drive off. He comes into the TARDIS and he's just normal, you know, like he's just someone who's been bereaved. Rose asks him if he's all right, and he says, yeah, I'm always all right. But the mask has dropped. The doctor performance has stopped for a bit. But it is Mickey. You're right, Todd. It's Mickey who's the one who realizes that the doctor should be left alone.
On the Mickey thing, sorry, if I can just add one more thing to that. The making fun of Mickey, though, there is still one remnant of it.
Yeah.
And it's the when Rose says, you're not keeping the horse. And he says, I let you keep Mickey. And now that's kind of acceptable because it's just a bit of banter, but it's still that kind of leftover bit of, you know, oh, Mickey's just a piece of like an extraneous character.
Yeah.
You know, he'll probably get killed by the end of the season because he doesn't really care. He doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And
what colour is his shirt?
Well, exactly. But if I can also say that regret scene in the TARDIS at the end with Tennant's reading the note and everything, it starts when he spins the fireplace around after Renette said, oh, actually, no, this is still here, and he works it out. And he goes, yeah, it's great, and he clicks it, and the thing starts spinning around, and she says, no.
Yeah, wish me luck.
And then the look on his face, and I'm not a fan of David Tennant as the Doctor, but that look on his face, it is just so, oh, my God, what have I just done? Because we've already established at the beginning that years can pass in the same fireplace. And it's that look on his face saying, am I just throwing this away? It's disappearing as I turn around. And I think that's beautiful. And I think that's...
That's when he realizes that this could go terribly wrong. And I think that's when he realizes he's never going to see her again.
Yes, even though he shouts at her through the fireplace then and says, pack your things, you know.
Yeah.
But that's almost like sort of out of place, because by then he should have said, you know, don't move away from the fireplace, or someone stay by the fireplace, because if we don't, you know, 10 years will go past like they did last time.
But it's this emotional gravitas and the cleverness of Stephen Moffat's writing and the performances of the entire cast here at the end of this episode that moves you to tears.
Mm.
I was mentioning last week that I've got a stone cold heart when it came to like the Sarah Jane.
You're dead inside, aren't you?
Yes, apparently. When it came to the Sarah Jane episode now, I don't get anywhere near as emotional, right? But on the first viewing of that episode of Sarah Jane and of this, like I was in tears at the end of this. Like it's real testament to the writing and Stephen's ability to manipulate you in that way and the structure. It's a structure of the whole script.
But also actors work best when they've got good stuff to work with.
Yeah.
And I think he gives them, Moffat gives them the lines to do those performances. They don't just get conjured up, especially not in the modern era where, if I understand this right, and I might not, you know, in the olden days, they used to have weeks of rehearsal in a room in Acton or wherever it was. Whereas now, isn't it more like sort of rehearse, record, like modern television, quote unquote?
Yeah.
So they don't have that time to think, oh, wait a minute, maybe the character of Renette would say this, blah, blah, blah. So it's Moffat, yeah.
And it's him writing to his strengths because, you know, he starts with witty screwball romantic comedy where you have two clever, willful characters saying clever things to one another.
It's very coupling.
It's very coupling without the sexism, and it's something that he writes incredibly well. I mean, you have someone who is brilliant at sitcom dialogue.
Sort of a bit Love Actually, is what we say.
Well, yeah.
Not Love Actually. Yeah, it's Love Actually, the Christmas one. I can't
He's just very, very funny and very, very clever, and the dialogue just works incredibly well. It's just sparkling.
And just the way he seeds everything, like, you know, how does this woman link to the 51st century and then keeps coming back to it. You know, the ship is 37. When she is 37, she is complete. I just love all those little builds up, building up to that point in the script.
One of the complaints about RTD's era is that things aren't properly accounted for or things aren't always explained in dialogue. And, you know, people make that complaint that, you know, the conclusion of an episode just seems to come out of nowhere and people think it's sort of careless plotting. I actually don't think that's the case. I think that's the way Russell writes, and he chooses not to weigh things down with too much explanation. Here, Moffat is much, much more careful about providing explanations for things, and he creates this puzzle box plot and brings mysteries up, all of which get resolved until the very end when finally the why Renette question gets answered.
Yes, but they don't know.
No, and they never find out. That's something that they never find out.
And isn't that great?
Yeah, that is awesome. But he does cheat by making the shape of the world kind of preposterous. He does this with the Weeping Angels as well. The fact that what we have here is a spaceship that is powerful enough to punch bunches of holes in one person's timeline, that is populated by robots that for some reason decide to carve up the crew and then travel to various points in time in a particular person's timeline in order to chop off their head. And the whole thing is just hugely, hugely high concept. And it has the shape it has, not because that's a thing that might happen or, you know, like something that is thematically resonant or anything, but it enables the story to happen. And it's the same with the Weeping Angels. Nothing like the Weeping Angels could ever possibly evolve. You know, they're absolutely magic. They're just magic.
Yes, but you can make that criticism about any episode or virtually any episode. I mean, I think you mentioned it in Boomtown where Margaret's going to do whatever she's going to do to the nuclear power plant to do whatever it is so she can serve at home.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
I don't think that's a criticism so much.
Oh, it's just an observation. Yes. But Doctor Who has got so many of those that I think if you stop to worry about them, like, you know, I've been watching the Blu-ray of Genesis of the Daleks, and much as I absolutely adore that story from my childhood and everything, I was watching it and going, oh, but how does that work? I mean, if they've really been at war for 1,000 years and this and that and da 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 da.
That's right.
And you know, they create this world, which is just nonsense.
Yeah.
They'd never end up there.
It's two dome cities within walking distance
on the entire planet. Yes, they're within walking distance, like an hour's walk. So what I'm saying is, yeah, I get what you're saying, but I think to criticize this or to observe it's particularly about this episode.
I think Moffat in particular does these sort of strange high concept things that work as the episode's going along. Mm. But if you stop afterwards and sort of think, actually, what's happening here, it has a very strange shape. It's a world that has a very, very unusual
kind of
shape.
The world fits the structure of the plot, not the other way around.
Yeah,
it's the structure of the writing. It requires this to
tell that story.
To tell that particular story. Yeah. And that is not a criticism at all, because when you're watching it, the performances, the sparkling dialogue, the whole structure of it just takes you away.
If you compare it to, say, Gridlock, where Russell creates a world and then drops the Doctor in it and gives him something to do, and the shape of the world isn't determined by the type of story that he wants to tell. It's determined by the themes that he wants to explore. Here, I think it's the other way around.
But, I mean, in Gridlock, you've got all these cars on a freeway for God knows how many years, which is just completely
We'll get there.
And that's, yes, but and that's what I was going to add, is that the problem with something like Gridlock is it's perfectly fine until they happen to say that they've been in a traffic jam for 30 years or whatever it was. I can't remember the number, but it's an absurd number of years. And that level of absurdity, for some reason for me, makes me go, jolt, oh, that's just stupid. Whereas the fact that this spaceship can punch, you know, a dozen holes in this woman's timeline doesn't faze me at all. And
just to get a spare part.
Just to get a spare part. And I wonder, I make that not as a criticism of what you're saying, but just as an observation. Like, isn't that interesting that some things cross the silliness threshold and break you out of it, but then other things, oh, no, that's perfectly fine.
But I think, too, that Moffat is more interested in Doctor Who as a storytelling vehicle than Doctor Who as a sort of coherent account of an individual person's adventures in time and space. Probably.
I think that's as it should be.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I love the plot device that they just happened to move the original fireplace. She just moved it stone by stone, brick by brick.
I actually found that convincing, though, because she knew that that was where the Doctor appeared. Of course, she would do that. Like, I thought that that just about hung together as a plot point. Mm. But again,
Not just about.
Again, I didn't have any problem with that at all. Well,
but again, two, it's the only one that isn't blown out. And again, you know, all of the windows are blown out. He's just making this up, you know. All of the windows are blown out except the one in the fireplace, which we observed in the first scene, is very well built, you know.
Because it's offline or something.
Yeah, it's offline and all of that. Like,
oh, no, but it all works.
It all works.
Explained, but that's magic. Like what you were saying, there's some things as individuals take you out of things, you know. Yeah. We're all different and we all have different things that sort of go, oh, you know, that's okay or that's not.
For me, it sort of just indicates an approach that I approve of, which is that for him, plot and character are more important than world building.
Or emotional realism.
Well, no, time. But he can. Story. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I would actually suggest that all of the showrunners thus far have had that precise same vision, because they've handled it in different ways.
Yeah.
Even right up to Chibnall now. They're much more interested in the story than they are with that sort of inconvenience.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about 80s Doctor Who, it would be create a concept and then just have the Doctor, Tegan and Turlough, you know, getting captured and escaping for four episodes, then explosion and that's our story. Whereas we have actual proper plot, like proper story happening in a careful way, and then the world tailored around that in order to make the story work.
Doctor Who is in my DNA. I've always loved it, even Underworld. But the thing that the new series I've always struggled with a little is, and what makes it for me a different program, is the fact that they are 45-minute self-contained episodes. There's a sort of the fault is either one for me, one direction or another. Either they're trying to do a traditional four-part story but squeezed into 45 minutes. And yes, I know you get rid of the standing urgently in corridors thing.
That, and all the padding.
And all the padding in episode three being locked up, da-da-da-da. But what you lose is the sense of the passage of time, the epic feel, you know. And the other possibility is that there's just not enough, which is like Boomtown, much as I keep mentioning Boomtown because I've just listened to the podcast, but Boomtown is an example of an episode which I did not like at the time, but I like a lot more now because I can sort of see how it works. But it's just the exploration of an idea rather than a four-part story sort of squished in. The Girl in the Fireplace manages to, in 45 minutes, have that epic feel because of the way the pages of the book are squashed together. And when it finished, I sort of had the same feeling as when, you know, for instance, when I get to the end of, say, The Green Death, where you've gone through all of this period of time with these characters and they've changed, they've evolved, they think differently now to what they did at the beginning. And too often in modern Doctor Who, you just don't feel that. I still think, though, that the story would work beautifully as a traditional four-part story, with it adding in a few more subplots, you know, bringing in a few other things, having a bit more exploration of the 17th century or the 18th century, 17th century, is it? It would work so beautifully still, but it still works as a standalone 45.
It's really interesting, Simon, what you're saying there. Like, I mean, because remember as kids, like, we used to talk about the different characters in classic Doctor who aren't the companions, right?
Yes.
And very often in modern Doctor Who.
Who are they?
But here, I always remember Madame de Pompadour from this season. Like, she is like a character who stands out.
She is pretty much the single guest star. I mean, you've got the handsome king, the very handsome king.
Is he Louis the 15th or 14th?
Ben Turner as King Louis. Yeah, just wanted to say that, people.
Gorgeous.
We can look him up.
She's the Richard Mace, though, of the episode, in that she's the one character with a name, not just a title, who actually gets an amount of dialogue, and so there is time to explore her.
Unlike her little person she's strolling
in the garden.
In the gardens, who is Angel Colby from Merlin. She was Guinevere. And last week we had Anthony Stewart Head, who was also in Merlin. So a few Merlin connections in these couple of episodes.
So I think that character's called Catherine. And that's a great scene because it's outdoors. You know, we're in the studio for most of this, but that's actually quite a lovely scene. And it is a romantic comedy scene with the Doctor ducking down behind, you know, a stone railing in order to stay out of sight.
It also manages not to whitewash history as well.
Yeah.
I mean, not so much anymore, but certainly in classic costume drama made by the BBC or ITV, history was always white, like uniformly white. And television was uniformly white. And they actively made a choice there to get a black actress.
And there are plenty of black extras as well in the scenes too.
Yeah, no, like, but I think they talked about that in Confidential.
Right.
That they specifically made sure that they had a diverse cast.
Has anyone seen Casanova?
Yeah.
The Russell T. Davies thing just before Doctor Who. That's what it feels like to me, because that also, I think, had that sort of diverse casting.
Yeah. It's definitely the kind of rehearsal, the audition piece, isn't it, for Doctor Who? And he does go on to cast some of the other people in Casanova, and we'll get to that when we talk about Fear Her.
Oh, yes. Mm. Can I also observe, though, the other comparison I want to make with Casanova, and one of the things I don't like about the episode is the makeup and hair, there's something about it which feels it's not. It doesn't feel authentic. I know we
it's too modern.
Yes, it's like, you know, even, you know, King Louis's early 21st century stubble and the hair and the makeup of Renette and so on. It's kind of like a nod to historical, but it's and I know it's a production choice and it's a stylistic choice.
It's a deliberate production.
I know, and I wonder why they do that sort of thing, because for me it's like, oh, it doesn't feel as authentic as it could feel. And even the lighting as well. I mean, yes, they've made a lot of effort to have shadows and, you know, as if the whole thing's being lit by candles. But there's not that flickering. There's not that. There's something about it which I don't think would have been difficult to achieve, which you see in plenty of other historical costume dramas of the modern era, whether it's Victoria or what have you.
Look, I would tend to agree with you on that. As somebody who, for a lot of their life, studied history, I get that. Quite often, you know, it's to make it accessible and it's an active production choice to make it understandable to the modern audience. And
I find that a very peculiar reason. Like, not the reason, but why this would make it inaccessible.
I actually think authenticity in a historical thing is something that you're never going to get. And I don't know that it's something that you should be aiming for.
In the opposite direction,
do you have historical dramas which show
how bad everyone's teeth were?
Yes,
Or the
feces.
Yeah, like, we need more lice.
No, obviously, no. Yeah. But there is. I suppose. I mean, obviously, historical productions are always, they make certain choices, and it's going to be. I mean, there are the ones which are really gritty and grotty, and there are the ones which are a bit more romanticized, where everyone's got good teeth and clean, and they don't smell and so on, but. I think this is a choice which for me is just a little bit too far trying to make it contemporary. And I think that if they are the excuses, and I don't know whether they are, but if they are the excuses or the rationale, I think it's a very poor one.
I think they described it as a rock and roll version of...
Casanova, tenants wandering around in Casanova, I seem to recall, with like gelled early 21st century hair. And, you know, it's kind of like, really? I mean, compare it to, and I was comparing it to because of the scene at the end where the horse, you know, comes through the glass of the mirror. Mask of Mandragora. It's like the mask scene in Mask of Mandragora. Now, maybe it's just because I saw that when I was like 8, but for me, and that's what, you know, Renaissance Italy is like.
See, I don't have a problem with that aspect of it because I find the spaceship to be rather dark and metallic and it's falling apart and it's all highly robotic and, you know, with body parts and all that sort of thing. And then you cut to the opposite where it's all romantic and brightly lit and love story. So, on that level, that's how I see it.
Draw that contrast.
Yes.
And it's Doctor Who's aesthetic during this period, an aesthetic that it's only just shed, of everything being kind of hyper-real and oversaturated and that kind of thing, a slightly cartoonish aesthetic, which is what they're going for.
And which then becomes fairy tale for a number of years.
Yeah. But it's certainly consistent with that. And this is a fairy tale. I mean, this is a fairy tale. The Doctor makes up a technical term for the fireplace specifically so that he doesn't have to call it a magic door, which is just what it is. It's a magic door.
And this is really, it's Moffat cutting his teeth on how he will make Doctor Who.
Yeah. Well, I think the way that you go through the magic door as well, where there's no sort of silly vortex or anything.
Thing.
It just turns around like...
It's a practical effect.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's great.
Yeah.
Listeners might be taking note of the times where I have memory lapses since last season. You know how I've been talking about the fact that I can't remember slabs of things for some reason with the new series. It happened again here. I was watching it all the way through. I'm going, is Rose and Mickey ever really going to meet Madame de Pompadour? Yeah. So that entire bedroom sequence where, you know, she talks about the slow path and all that, I completely erased it from my head.
I really like that scene.
It's great.
It's really good. The two of those women are excellent. And I think, again, you know, for the second time this season, they've had a sort of historical where they haven't put Rose in a frock and she's just sort of standing there in the T-shirt opposite another intelligent young woman dressed in sort of 17th century gear. I think it's wonderful.
But no, coming back to this, I enjoyed this as much as if not slightly more than ever. It's my joint favourite of this season for me.
Yeah, I think that my habit of leaving the Moffat stuff on the table really needs to be reevaluated, because I thought this was exceptionally good.
It's the first early new series episode I've watched in many years. Usually I'm just watching where we're up to. And I came back to it wondering what to expect, and I was actually blown away. I thought it was even better than I remember it to be. The concept behind it is mature and intelligent. It's timey-wimey without being over the top and stupid about it. It doesn't dig itself holes that it can't then get out of later and just solves with a big explosion. I think, as I've said before, the silliness is an aside rather than central, and it really is everything that Doctor Who should be for me.
Well, dear listener, we've reached that part of the series where it's time for a controversial two-part story set on the planet Earth or its nearest equivalent. We'll see you next week, and just a little bit to the left, for Rise of the Cybermen. In the meantime, you can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find us at our Series 11 flashcast, Jodi into Terror, which is at jodiintoterror.com, Jodi into Terror on Apple Podcasts, and at Jodi into Terror on Twitter. And we're also available on Bondfinger, our commentary podcast on the James Bond franchise and a bunch of other silly things. You can find that at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Simon, where can people find you?
You can hear me on Fine Music 102.5 FM in Sydney. And if you're not in Sydney, you can stream it at finemusicfm.com. And I have been known to play the Doctor Who theme once or twice in my time.
Brilliant. All right. So until next time, may you remember to keep your vessel's auto repair system switched off at all times. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
See you soon.
Good night.
Bye for now.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bilby, Nathan Bottomley, Simon Moore and James Selwood. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. Strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Tropes for want of a better word, was recorded on the 26th of January 2019 and released on the 7th of April. Of course, Moffat's original, much more upsetting premise involved the SS Theresa May, which saw the entire population of Britain trapped on a spaceship, repeatedly reliving the events of the past 3 years. Don't do the story titles yet.
I'm just seeing if we've got anything else. Working titles. You know that Moffat lifted the whole description of the Doctor being what monsters are scared of from
Paul Cornell. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
It's a new adventurism.
Yeah. Mm. Love and War.
Doesn't he say, I'm the Lord of Time at some point in this?
Not in this, I don't think.
Yeah, no, he's the king says, I'm King of France, and he says, I'm the
Lord of Time. Oh, that, yes, no, that's beautiful.
I love that moment.
Yeah, that's a very good line. There are a few other kind of cultural references in there, like with Camilla being referenced.
Yeah.
When did they get married? It wasn't that long before then. Maybe not married.
Possibly after.
Actually, after, I think you're right. So she's still the girlfriend mistress at that point. And the Mr. Thickety Thick from Thickton or whatever it was. Is that sort of just specific Pixelvania? Yeah, is that a sort of a Blackadderism, or is that, because I wasn't sure whether it was unique to Blackadder or whether it was just a generic British thing.
I think it's a specific Blackadder thing because it's a frocks and wigs story.
Yeah. And it's got the sort of the feel of the Blackadder.
Is that when he's drunk?
Well, when he's playing drunk, to be fair, because I think that is actually quite good, where he comes in pretending he's drunk and then so he can pull a swift one on the robots,
yes.
Which we haven't actually commented on yet, if I can.
Yeah.
They are so beautifully designed, and the masks, which are almost reminiscent of the clowns from Greatest Show, I sort of thought. I don't think it's a homage to, I think it just happens to be because they're a painted face.
And the Doctor says, oh, you're so beautiful, and he's just said that 2 weeks prior to the werewolf as well. It was interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Now that you say that, it was a bit tedious at the time. It's like, we're just using the same kind of thing. Oh, you're beautiful, but I have to destroy
you. Also, I think you're about to say something similar. Sorry. It shows how he's different. Like, his aesthetics are different from the average human. Like, he's
being, you know, he's being menaced by a werewolf and he stops to admire its beauty and it.
And here they're being menaced by these clockwork soldiers and he's saying, oh, you're so beautiful and everything, when other people would just run screaming from the room.
I mean, they're ludicrously impractical again.
Oh, of course.
But the clock thing, you know, in a story about the passage of time works terribly well, and the broken clock thing is another sort of very clever Moffatism where they break the clock so that you don't notice them ticking.
And, of course, he'll revisit it at the beginning of Series 8.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the villains in sort of exaggerated masks thing, that's a well that he'll go back to a few more times, I think, before he's done with the show. But that's only, I think, because it's a good idea. And when their masks are off, where it's that sort of glass ovoid with actual proper moving clockwork in it, I just think it looks incredible. Just looks wonderful. I think, like you and I have both said, had a concluding thing. James, do you want to say something and then Simon say something, or are you good?